Siren Radio.
Not beautiful and grotesque. Surely that couldn't be said about the Santiago pilgrimage, could it, William?
No, you wouldn't call it. It is beautiful and it's bizarre, but no, grotesque is not the right word.
Okay. Well, anyway, we're continuing to march on a merry little way here on Siren Radio. How has it been? It's almost all over now. You've made it to Santiago. Is it a case of congratulations and high fives all round? Your sins have been forgiven, and it's just onwards to Whitsuntide.
Yes. Though, being a Protestant, I think that my sins are forgiven every single day. It's only you Catholics, Alex, who believe that you have to go to Santiago.
On a day when the Pentalum Luminarium has actually opened its doors to the citizens of Lincoln, well, actually, it technically opens tomorrow, it was a press day today, which had a monumental and interactive walk-in sculpture of Architects of Air and designer Alan Parkinson just outside the University of Lincoln's main Minerva building here. We can't get into battling our differences. We've got to celebrate our commonalities here, surely.
Quite right, too, yes. Anyway, my sins have been forgiven. Yep, I'm like a newborn now.
Any regrets at all, Bill? Or was it a case of no? Or is it a case of this is the sort of thing an author has to do in order to actually get the inspiration for my next novel?
No, I think anyone should have a go on the Camino. It was terrific. My only slight regret was that I didn't have quite the right gear. I'm sorry it might be wet, but I had no idea it was going to be quite as wet as it has been. And going through Storm Hugo was amazing. Everything was saturated in my bag. We all were like drowned rats.
Well, at least you didn't actually go along a Noah routine. You weren't asked to build an ark halfway through. Otherwise, it could have been more sort of concerning from that point of view. So what's the situation now? Is it a case of on the next plane back to Edinburgh to actually say, yes, my children, I have returned, your father has emerged triumphant, and wife, put the kettle on, William's back in town?
I've got a couple of days here. So I've been wandering around Santiago de Compostela, but tomorrow I'm going to Coruña, or as we used to call it at school, Corunna, and to check out the Battle of Coruña, where Sir John Moore was killed, and where it was the Napoleonic equivalent of Dunkirk, where the British forces just managed to get out of the harbour with their tail between their legs.
Well, I'm pleased you mentioned a historical aspect there, Bill, because it brings us around to our next co-host and presenter who'll be making his debut on the production, historian Adrian Grant, who actually was quoted in your old little Rupert Murdoch organ, The Sun, a matter of hours ago, actually. And they obviously took a distinctive southern-based accent to this with By Ecalibur. King Arthur was actually from Yorkshire, capital letters, according to historian. Yep. Adrian Grant claims the Round Table legend was born in Barrack in Elmet near Leeds in AD 475 and not in Tintagel, Cornwall. Now, I mean, presumably now you're based in north of Alnwick, you might well sort of say, yes, typical. Those southerners from Cornwall claiming King Arthur is one of their own, they were wrong. Any thoughts on this, or is it a case of, well, that's what historians will actually do when they start looking at crude 15th century illustrations of Arthur, who are actually born in Yorkshire and not in Cornwall?
It's possible. Are we saying that Tintagel is in Yorkshire as well, or did he just decide to move off to Wales?
I think what we've actually got here, according to, obviously, the publicity that we've had, and we are chasing this up in a matter of moments, so Adrian will have a chance to actually respond to this. Adrian's theory flies in the face of ancient beliefs that the king was born in Tintagel, Cornwall. It also challenges those who say Arthur, his sword Excalibur, and wizard Merlin are a myth. The retired historian spent 6 years studying ancient texts about 12 battles the supposed Saxon basher is believed to have fought in. That's not a very friendly phrase, is it, supposed Saxon basher? Are we thinking Brexit all over again here? Surely not. He says Arthur was the son of Maswit Glof, a 5th century king who ruled over the kingdom of Elmet, now the West Riding of Yorkshire. He was born around 475 AD in the kingdom's capital, Barrack in Elmet, and his family castle would have stood on or near to Hall Tower Hill, once an Iron Age fort.
Right. Mm. Okay. I thought his father was Uther Pendragon.
Well, this is, again, another question we need to raise. Adrian apparently says that Arthur fought Picts and Scots before dying at the Battle of Camlann in 537. And according to the historical records he's found, you have an individual with the right name that fits.
Right, OK, what about Merlin?
It claims Merlin was also there. We're going to follow that through a little bit more because he's also claiming that Arthur looks just like Jon Snow's character in Game of Thrones. So that would be spooky, wouldn't it? It was Westeros, written large. Still, never let it be said
we'll give him a good grilling.
Well, we'll endeavour to do so. We should be joined as well by writer Dawn G. Harris, who I had hoped that you would share a few words with, but Dawn has been driving up together with Paul Spearing from Surrey to actually get here today, and they miscalculated. They miscalculated the time it took to get from Surrey, England, to Lincoln, England, and hopefully they'll arrive before the end of the show. That's all we say. Fingers crossed. The book that Dawn's just written is Diviner. And according to horror writer Graham Masterton, the debut of a shining and unusual new writing talent. Would you like to have a little bit of the press blurb for Diviner? Or the line, Bill, just to get flavour in terms of what Diviner's about?
Yeah, I'd love to hear what the blurb is.
Well, it goes as follows. Clarissa Davenport has two problems. The first is that her childhood talent of being able to see people's true characters reflected on their faces has alarmingly returned. The second is that she is being stalked by a terrifying ethereal child, a boy who appears unexpectedly and always with malicious intent. And then the horrific deaths start. Challenges of daily life become shadowed by his evil and her need to exude strengths she didn't know she had.
OK, sounds great. Why can't you just get her on her mobile phone while she chugs into Lincoln?
Yeah, that was something which has passed my mind. And in fact, the original plan was we'd do it as a straight phoner. But no, she said, I'll come into the studio. 2.5 hours away. So I feel having been dedicated to that. And I did actually try to reach her, spoke to Paul, and was informed that Dawn was just washing her hands at the time. I thought, well, just steady on. You know, clearly they've got a very important, large vehicle that they're driving in. So let's see what actually happens. Worry not, because after Adrian Grant, we'll be speaking to Paul Zollo, based in Los Angeles, of course, rock music writer and fine critic and philosopher, it might be said. Larry Nemajek, Dr. Trek, will be back with us, as will Phil Hurdwood. And Phil Leonis will wrap up this first Wednesday of April 2018's Midweek Drive. That's what we call in the business training ahead just a tad. And apart from checking out the joys of Corinna, or Corinna, or any sort of pronunciation you'd like to say.
Corunya,
exactly. When will you be coming back to the north for us to regale with your delights in post-Santiago?
I'll be back on Saturday, but first on Friday, I have to see one of the world's biggest thuriballs. Have you ever used that word before, a thuriball?
I have to be honest, no.
It is also known as a botafumeiro, or an incense burner. And the ones in the cathedral at Santiago de Compostela are vast and hold about 100 weight of incense, and they're swung up and down the cathedral. And they were designed initially to make the locals, the peasants, smell a little bit better and try and kill all the ticks and other animals that they brought into the cathedral. And anyway, it doesn't swing very often, but it will be swinging on Friday night. And I shall be there, showered with incense.
Well, clearly, this is an essential part which should be re-emerged for the 21st century and adopted by radio stations up and down the land. I shall say no more, but there we are. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today, William Coles?
Yes, I have. As always, thank you.
Will you be back with us in 7 days from now? Or to you, Bill, 168 hours.
Yes, I will. Thank you. Love to be on.
Spring was never waiting for us, girl. It ran one step ahead as we followed in the dance. We'll be right back.
to pages and were pressed in love's hot fevered iron like a striped pair of pants. MacArthur's Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing flowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again. Oh no. I recall the yellow cotton dress foaming like a wave on the ground around your knees. The birds like tender babies in your hands, and the old men playing checkers by the trees. MacArthur's Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing flowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have the recipe again.
And from the Department of Tenuous Links, clearly Richard Harris, who portrayed King Arthur in Camelot singing MacArthur Park, kind of connects us from Santiago in Spain all the way through to former secondary school teacher and ace historian Adrian Grant. Welcome to the programme, Adrian. How are you?
Hello, thank you very much. I'm well.
Yeah. Excellent. Based, of course, in Fife, we believe.
That's right.
Marvellous. So William Coles, who's just completed the pilgrimage in Santiago, he's living in Edinburgh these days, I'm sure it's not too far away. But let's go on to talk about this fascinating aspect, which, as we mentioned earlier, has appeared in a whole range of things, including the Sun newspaper, who actually adopted the line by Excalibur.
Yes.
I'm not sure I would go along with respect to that. But this whole notion of King Arthur being real and proving that God's own country is indeed Yorkshire, it's actually not the notion of the South West that is proud of Arthur. We should be proud of him in Yorkshire, let alone
That's
Lincolnshire.
Correct. That's right, yes.
Share with us, how did you come up with this particular area, this fascinating thing, and also what does this mean for the likes of Merlin, of course?
Well, okay, let's dispose of Merlin first. There were two Merlins. Neither of them had anything to do with Arthur. One was far too early and one was far too late. So we could ignore Merlin. Merlin got into the mythology because of the Arthurian romance. And the Arthurian romance is explained in the tale of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, in which the author says that Arthur would not sit down to a feast until a fantastic story had been told. So much of the Arthurian romance is in fact entertainment, satire, featuring real people but not necessarily their real names.
Okay.
And intended to entertain the throng before a feast, and therefore has little or nothing to do with what he actually did in terms of fighting.
And the notion of Arthur's father being Uther Pendragon, is that a case of, no, that's something completely different. Is that also
a
fiction?
No. Pendragon means army commander-in-chief. Okay? Uther, I say, is a reference to King Riddoch of Strathclyde, from whom we get Carruthers, for example. That means Riddoch's castle. Uther, you see, Carruthers. So he belongs to a time, again, considerably after Arthur, so that's absolutely not the case either. But essentially, I didn't worry about these things when I was doing the research. I started off by saying, okay, what can we do to pin down the time scale? And the fact is that the figures are there. Gildas, the monk Gildas, refers to the relief of the siege of Bardon Hill, which was the culmination of the Arthurian campaign in his lifetime. The Welsh annals also have that date as 517. And they also have the date of Arthur's death around 537. I think there's another source that gives 542. But, I mean, that's so close as to be it's not particularly important. So we know that roughly when Arthur was living, you see. So then the next thing to do, or the next thing I did, was to look back at the context. And Gildas explains about how the Britons were fed up with the enemy. And it turns out that the enemy were not the Anglo-Saxons, who were not flexing their muscles yet by that time, really. It was actually the Picts and the Scots, who were flooding into what is now England, plundering and causing mayhem. I thought, right, we've got to do something about this. And the local tribes at the Antonine Wall, namely the Damnonii and the Gododin, were just not up. They didn't have the strength of numbers. They needed support from the Old North of what is now England. And so that's what happened. The Old North said, right, we're fed up with all this raiding. We're going to put our people in. But the deal is this. If we're going to supply our troops, it's got to be our man in charge. So they selected Arthur to be the titular commander-in-chief.
Now, it's often said that history is the system of one set of beliefs replacing another set of beliefs. I appreciate that's open to contentious notions, and there are colleagues here at the University of Lincoln who say, oh, where's he going with respect to this? But clearly you've spent 6 years really setting out to prove or disprove Arthur's existence. You've done this in terms of methodology by looking at 12 major battles.
Yeah.
Were you surprised by the findings? I mean, you know, the notion of Arthur being in Yorkshire to many people would have been kind of up there with, well, yes, of course, but let's...
I just love it. I mean, it's just so ironic because you've got all these people trying to claim that Arthur's theirs, And it turns out that Arthur comes from somewhere that nobody's claimed, you know, and that is, of course, Barwick-in-Elmet, which is now part of Leeds, because he was the second son of the King of Elmet at the time.
And in terms of, as I say, that notion of, clearly they do say the best things in life come from Yorkshire and Arthurian legend and so on, was that something which you kind of felt, yes, jolly good, or would you prefer if he'd actually been based in Lincolnshire or Cumbria, for instance?
Well, I mean, I have to say that I had no view about this at all. Hmm. I set out only to discover the truth. I'd written a book previously where I'd been looking at the origins of the Clan Grant, which then expanded into an examination of huge amounts of Scottish history, which well-known facts that turn out to be wrong. And I'd mentioned Arthur a couple of times just to discount the Arthurian connection, not only to the MacArthurs, but also to the arms covering the coffin of Henry V. And a reviewer chose to take me to task and, you know, why did I mention Arthur and wasn't I overdoing things? Red rag to bull. I'm just going to look here and see what I can find out.
I'm fascinated by the notion of actually looking at things with a geographer's eye, because clearly one of the subjects you used to teach at school was geography. In terms of that, was that looking at it from the overview of the articles? Because clearly, when you're looking at documents, and we're not, well, we're presumably looking at a range of primary resources, etc., in some ways, 1,500 years or thereabouts is quite a hike to sort of go back in time to start finding out reliable evidence, particularly when oral history is the prime way in which people are actually putting those things together. There's not a great deal of material.
I'm not sure I even agree with that. I mean, I think there are written sources which have not survived, but some of the errors that creep into later work on Arthur demonstrate that they were relying on written sources rather than oral sources. But when it comes to geography, the point is this: if you're going to have a battle, you've got to take into account the lie of the land. You've got the logistical problem. How do you get your army where you want to go? All these things. Now, looking at previous people who've written about Arthur, they tend to scatter the battlefields in a sort of fairly random fashion. They think, oh, this will do. They don't take into account, how do you get the army there? Why would there be a confrontation there?
Are we guilty, actually, of looking longingly at the past, pretty much because Malory and La Motte d'Arthur has kind of almost acted as propaganda? It's kind of influenced us beyond words that actually, you're going to tell us next, that Lancelot was probably from, I don't know, South Shields.
As a matter of fact, I can tell you exactly where Lancelot was from. He was from a place called Cashel in Munster. His real name, we don't know his real name. But Lancelot has come down to us. He was Saint Kethog. And he was baptized by Saint Patrick himself, probably brought to Scotland by Saint Patrick himself. And he did a lot of work around Loch Lomond after Loch Lomond had been annexed to the Kingdom of Strathclyde. Now, he apparently his son was Galahad. Now, that's a problem, because Galahad was not a name that would have been appropriate to that time. And I tried to parse it as Gala or Gile, servant of Ad, you see. And I'm told this is not possible, and I accept it's not possible. However, it's also the case that the Irish king who tried to attack Arthur was called, in the legends, is called Gilamurius, but his real name is Muradach Mac Muradag. And so you can see how the Gilla bit has sort of come in, and that's a later gloss. So taking off the Gilla from Galahad, you end up that probably he was called Aidan. And I say that because he actually had a brother called Fillan, who was one of the Saint Fillans, who worked in Scotland as well in the immediately post-Arthurian time. So yes, Lancelot is a real person. His father was a king called Angus Mac Nagfroich.
Will this mean that the West Riding of Yorkshire will suddenly start putting up tourist signs saying, here was born Arthur, the son of Masgwyd Glough?
I hope so. It's time. I mean, the Yorkshire people are plain-speaking people, and they tend not to want to put people on pedestals. But I think it would be good for the tourist industry. And the Tower Hill at Barrack in Elmet is a wonderful, it's a lovely place. It's begging to be visited. I would hope that anybody interested in Arthur would go and visit it, yes.
And in terms of the mythology of Camelot, which clearly echoes through the Kennedy era, the Star Trek future history era, the whole notion of Camelot, and let us not forget the musicals and so on, was that kind of rooted in the philosophy, or is that something else?
Yeah, which... I'm sure that's true as well. If you think of the magnificence of the Sutton Hoo burial hoard, I mean, there's no doubt that Arthur enjoyed some degree of luxury. Now, we can identify the location of Camelot very easily. First of all, there were many Camelots, because Camulos was the Celtic god of war. So if you were a military commander, why would you not try and seek the help of your god of war by naming your headquarters after him? So there's plenty of places called Camulos or Camulodunum or whatever. But this particular one, Arthur's one, is on the Antonine Wall. It's now called Rough Castle, and it's a few hundred yards from several different Roman camps over different periods called Camelon.
Obviously, Arthur, Legend, Logic and Evidence is out and about and available now from all good bookstores and online and sources as well. Has any Cornish people, have they sort of threatened to declare outrageousness at this side of things? Or are they not aware of it as yet?
Well, I have spoken to one person who's got a particular connection to Tintagel.
Mm.
And I have to say to you that I have no problem with the idea that Arthur has a connection to Tintagel. I haven't looked into it, but it's perfectly possible. Because after Arthur had nailed the Picts and the Scots in roughly 517, there was 20 years until his death. I don't attempt to go into what he did during that time, because I don't find any evidence for it. But I'm sure, for example, he would have gone home. I'm sure he would have helped to put down any aggravation caused by the Anglo-Saxons, who were just beginning to come out of their shell at that time. They weren't doing any serious damage, but they were causing a bit of mayhem. So he may well have tried to sort them out. There's no reason why he couldn't have visited the West Country, Wales, even Brittany. All these things are possible. You've got 20 years to do it in, for goodness sake.
Adrian, it's been fascinating getting an insight in terms of the notion of the real King Arthur. We haven't even had a chance to talk about Game of Thrones, but that's for another issue another time. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you?
It's been great. Thank you very much indeed.
In which case, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the not-too-distant future and keep us appraised of Arthur, Legend, Logic and Evidence?
Because I would be delighted to.
There's much more to be said about this whole thing. I'll just pick up my sword and shield. 27 minutes to 6 o'clock, and we've just heard the excellent news that Ace author Dawn G. Harris has actually arrived in Lincoln. She's not too far away from the studio and will be joining us in the very near future, all being well. She's made it to Lincoln. She should be able to find it to the Siren Radio studios. And upcoming next, we are heading off to our music scholar extraordinaire, based, of course, in California, in Los Angeles, California, no less. That would be the fabulous Paul Zollo.